Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Pod Stallions, the official podcast of PodStallions.com. I am your host, Brian, and with me, as always, way over there is Jason Lindsay.
Hello, everybody.
And we've got a new episode, and yesterday was his birthday, and our subject matter is Jack King Kirby. But before we get
all
to
that...
All
hail the king.
All hail the king. Before we get to that, you wanted to make an announcement, Jason.
Yes. I wanted to make an announcement. Everybody, hope you're all sitting down. If you're not, I'll wait. Okay, everyone's sitting down? All right. We just wanted to say that we've gotten some comments here and there about the disparity between Brian's voice and mine with the audio. I'm doing this through a headset, which I don't think comes through all that clearly. We had some problems with Skype, and if anybody wants to come over, you come over and check out my laptop to see if we can get it to work. But we've had problems getting it to work on my end. I'm sure it's my fault. So I just want to apologize.
P.S. I also hate Skype.
For the quality of some of the recordings. Hopefully, the juice of what we're talking about, or what I'm saying anyway, sort of comes through regardless. Or maybe you just turn me down, I don't know, and just listen to Brian. Which would be an interesting show in itself, I think, if you just heard Brian.
Man talks to self? That's the show I tape in the car.
You could improv it at home. Just
yeah.
Turn me down. So we're working on that. And also, we've been getting some notes from people about the frequency of the episode. We try to do it about once a month, but we're stepping it up.
Yeah.
And we're trying to do maybe two a month if we can, or, you know, every few weeks, and then we do a mini one, and then, you know, the next one, and so on. Because, again, if you want it and people are asking for it, we're gonna do more. It's nice to hear the comments, because that kind of motivates us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I get so much of that through YouTube and through Twitter that it's like I'm really grateful to hear it. I'm glad people want to hear more of us. And it's not like we don't like each other. It's not like behind the scenes we're fighting. So let's just do more of this. This is fun.
Yeah, and it's hard to gauge. Just, I mean, I see some, you know, familiar faces, you know, with the comments, and I hear stuff from Brian. But it's hard to really gauge just what the audience is or how big it is, I think. So it's good, you know, like I say, it's good to know that, and we're gonna do more because we love doing it, and God knows we have plenty of crap to talk about.
Oh sure, yeah.
So I just wanted to say that before we got into celebrating the work of Jack Kirby. And
I wanted to bring something on you that I wondered if you knew, because on Twitter today, somebody came after Plaid Stallions. Did you know this? There's an alternate ending to Flash Gordon. Is this real?
The movie?
Yes.
The movie?
Yeah, I was just sent a picture of Ming standing in a, what looks like a skull. Looks like
the Clytus mask.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Clytus mask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, this is one of the reasons I'm so fascinated with this movie. And when I did the, you know, it's one of these things that there has never been a making of sort of documentary. The closest we've gotten is Life After Flash, which Lisa Downs, you know, produced and directed, and I'm in it. But it's mainly to do with the film that sort of exists. There's lots of stuff that we talked about that didn't make it into the movie about the making of stuff. So that's the closest we've ever gotten to this.
Okay.
There's not a lot of printed stuff out there. There's not a lot of, you know, websites devoted to the ins and outs. There's some stuff. And a lot of this stuff is still kind of a mystery. For example, you know, I know for certain that Sam Jones' voice was dubbed through about 75-80% of the movie because he didn't come back for ADR.
Yeah, didn't we figure out, we kind of figured out who that was, too.
We thought, Lisa thought that she did, but it turned out that that wasn't the case. And it's still this mystery. Nobody knows who this guy was.
Oh.
It's clearly a British actor doing an American accent. She thought she did, but apparently that wasn't. It was one of the Gerry Anderson shows, and it wasn't that guy.
Apparently. Oh,
so stuff like that. In addition, there are sequences. There's one sequence that Melody Anderson talks about in an issue of Starlog, where she sat in makeup for like 5 hours. To be made up like a spider woman, like not like the superhero, but like a spider. Like she had, you know, prosthetics on her face and weird hair, and then these feet that came out, or arms or whatever, and this weird, bizarre thing she's talking about. And then she said, right when she's about ready to go on to the set, Mike Hodges, the director, said, "You know what? We're gonna cut this scene. We're not gonna do this scene." And they never did it. I have no idea what she's talking about, but it's something to do with maybe something, you know. Flash had drank a potion or something, and then he saw her this way, or I don't know what, but some kind of weird sequence that never got filmed that she was in makeup for. And there's other shots that have shown up, you know, set shots and behind the scenes stuff like that, where in addition, so you've got that shot of Ming with all those skulls around him. Well, Peter Wingard talked about it when I did the BAFTA thing, the 35th anniversary at BAFTA, and moderated that. They were talking about Clytus was going to come back in the next one. And the idea was that there were many Clytuses.
Ah.
I think the idea that Wingard had must have come from something that was shot that we never saw that has to do with that room, as if it was in there once Clytus is dead and then puts the mask on something else and it becomes Clytus, or, you know, I don't know. There's lots of weird stuff like that, you know, we try to pick up the crumbs and figure out what, because I think there was a lot of stuff that, you know, as we've talked about, the translation between the English, you know, in the script with the Italian crew and Dino De Laurentiis, there was a lot of stuff that didn't quite translate very well. And I think there were a lot of running changes that were made during the movie. There's a lot of stuff that they had to do without Sam. When Sam never came back, they shot a lot of stuff with a body double, you know, for different sequences. And I think there's a good chunk of stuff that never sort of made it into the film. And I think that's probably what someone's talking about. I don't know if the footage exists, but I've certainly never seen anything extra that come out of that movie. Nothing has been done for it, really.
Okay, I just was really curious because I didn't know that, and I thought, well, if anyone will know that, it's you, and you did. Okay, so not that I was trying to stump you.
So you won that.
What bet?
Yeah, that's what I think is. I think that would someone would assume that there's an alternate ending, and I'm sure there were different things that were shot, but I've certainly never seen the footage.
Oh man. That bothers me. Yeah. I would like to see more. More of that world.
Yeah, I keep... In this world where, like, everything, you know, no offense, but I know, like, the Return of Swamp Thing got a deluxe Blu-ray thing with extras and interviews and everything else.
It sure did.
You think something like Flash Gordon, this legendary movie now, would get some kind of two-disc Blu-ray deluxe thing with every interview you can think of, and no one's done it.
Swamp Thing is a legendary film as well.
Yes, it is legendary in a way. It is legendary as well. Yes.
Hey, I can talk to the director on Facebook. I really like him.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. That's nice. One of the guys, speaking of social media, one of the guys that was co-designer on Rogue One and Solo started following me on Twitter.
Oh, wow.
I have no idea how or why. I've never talked about Solo on there, but he liked something I wrote, and he started following me.
Hmm.
That's kind of cool.
I think the biggest follower I picked up this month is an actor who played Jason in a couple of the Friday the 13th movies, Twitter. mentioned.
Oh, nice.
Made special notice of it. And it's like, neat.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but that's pretty noteworthy. All right.
I'm also friends on Twitter with Carrie Fisher's dog, Gary the dog.
Wow.
And Carrie used to write for the dog. Like,
oh,
something would get posted and then she'd write. And I became friends, but thanks for the ad, and I sent her a picture of Bowie on Twitter. And she's like, pretty cute. Have you got any nudes? And then I posted another picture of Bowie with kind of his belly, kind of his legs a little spread. And I posted that, and then it never got a response. But in a way, I've had a conversation with Carrie Fisher.
That's really cool. That's really cool. I was over the moon. 1 month I got Elvira to retweet me and Jane Badler to retweet me.
Wow.
And it was like, all I need is Marky Post, and I have my 80s, you know, sexual fantasy trio here. But
you sure you're not thinking of Donnie Most?
Not thinking of Donnie Most. No, that was the 70s.
Okay.
I was really into Donnie.
Okay.
That's when the sun
set. Marky Post from The Fall Guy. Marky Post?
I prefer to be Marky Post from Night Court, but sure. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple years ago, I saw her at like a CVS. She was walking around, and I had to do like a triple take because, you know, it's been a few years, but it was definitely Marky Post. Yeah.
And you didn't bother her while she was buying, like, disposable razors and mouthwash?
I didn't. I didn't have it in me.
The only thing I'll ever do to a celebrity if I run into them like that is, like, nod. You know, I can't bother really famous people if they're in action.
No.
You know?
I love it when you sort of, they comment on something. They sort of, they start a conversation somehow.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of like, oh, well, technically, she started this conversation talking about the disposable razors or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have a little chat, and then you might go, hey, I really enjoy your work, by the way. And they usually really love it because nobody stops them anymore. So kind of makes their day.
My friend and I got stuck in an elevator with Kitten Natividad from Russ Meyer movies once. And we both did not know what to say to her. We just both stood there and nodded and smiled while we waited. And it's like, you know,
if ever there's a good time to talk, it's in a stalled elevator.
There was a 13-year-old inside me going, are you kidding me? You know, but anyway. let's get on to the King What was your first exposure to Jack Kirby?
Well, it's funny you say that because we've talked about this before with other topics, and the memory of something without really knowing what it was.
Okay.
And so I don't think I knew exactly who Jack Kirby was probably until, you know, my like junior high or something to really know.
Really?
You know, I might have recognized the name. No, but what I mean is, That is just the art that I always associated with Marvel Comics.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
But his versions of, you know, from the 70s, his versions of Captain America, and you know, sort of with the fist coming out towards you and the other hand up and back, and that just you know, was Marvel Comics to me.
Exactly.
Those Hulk shots, you know, and I didn't know at the time exactly who he was, but I knew that I loved this stuff. And then it's the more you start to see it, the more you kind of recognize it. And then there was the 2001 comic. I think they did like deluxe, like big deluxe type versions of it.
Treasury editions. Yeah.
Somebody had that, either the kid down the street, Mark, or it was my brother Gino, I forget. And that one had sort of hit me like, oh, this is the same guy that does this other stuff that I like, you know, because it's just the way you can just spot his stuff from a mile away, sort of.
Yeah,
and then the appreciation just grew as I got older.
I've been meaning to buy that 2001 Treasury Edition just because it's something I'd like to reevaluate. I think in L.A. or something, there's a museum that reproduced it, and they did a whole art show on it I was reading about.
They did. In fact, they had it at the Kirby booth at Comic-Con this year.
Had
it. Yeah, they made this massive repro of the Treasury Edition of 2001. And it's like, you know, it's the size of a, you know, a hatchback, it's like never, a Honda.
It's never been reprinted, has it?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I know there were individual issues, but I don't know about
I remember them. In fact, like my the Treasury Edition, you brought that up. That was my first introduction to Kirby, and that was a Fantastic Four Treasury Edition. It's probably one of the first. I still have it. It's not in great shape. That and a Spider-Man Treasury Edition were the first comics I really remember reading. And, of course, it was Ditko Spider-Man in large format, you know, and Kirby Fantastic Four. And the Kirby stuff knocked my socks off. I remember this was a period I got them probably when I was 5 and I couldn't read to, the first grade, a year later. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly remember, pouring over that, going, I want to know what's going on in this, and learning to read. That was the thing that was like, click, okay, now I understand the story. And the stories in there I could probably act out for you. They left such an impression on me. They're good ones, right? Dr. Doom's getting his revenge on the Fantastic Four. That's one of the stories. The other story is Sub-Mariner Returns, which of course is a classic, and the third story is in the book is This Man, This Monster, which is very thing centric.
The
thing I will remember forever about Kirby is and you're a child, I think he actually affected my spatial reasoning, because when you can't read and you're looking at this stuff and it's just ideas and concepts, that is the thing that always and the energy of it, and it's not boring. Even though I couldn't read, I would go through it and go like, okay, I think what's going on here is, and I was totally wrong, but I loved all of those things in there, other dimensions and lost kingdoms and it monsters and. So I was immediately a fan. And, of course, I've probably mentioned this before, but Captain America is one of my favorite superheroes of all time. So, and Falcon. Captain America and Falcon, that era.
That was the comics. That's one of the few books I read as a kid was the Captain America and the Falcon book, that title. And then that Mad Bomb story, the Kirby Bomb story, is one of the first.
Oh yeah, I had that too.
Things that I would get I'd have my brother grab it for me, or like, can you get the new count? And I kind of knew. I didn't really know who Kirby was when I was 7 or whatever, 6 or 7.
I
knew his stuff.
Yeah, and I wanted to tell you too that when I was when we sold my grandmother's house last year, and we had delayed the estate for a long time, I was going through the last few things, and it turns out that everything I ever drew, she kept.
Oh, wow.
And that was a very emotional day for me, I found this comic, and it must have been probably 1976 or 1977, barely, and I'm pretty sure that I had just gotten the Mego Falcon doll. But if I can find it, I'll put it up with the podcast. But it's Fanstick 4, because I can't spell.
Fantastic.
Featuring the Falcon. Amazing. And it is a note for note. I'm stealing the story from the Treasury Edition. Dr. Doom comes back. He kidnaps all the Fanstick, all the Fanstick 4. And then the Falcon beats the shit out of Dr. Doom, and they're saved. And it's just, that's where my head was at that time. That's what comics were
to
me.
That's amazing.
And
that's amazing.
You mentioned the 2001 individual issues, and this is where, as a kid, I loved Kirby. And then, I was just there this week. We have a thing called the CNE, the Canadian National Exhibition, and it's a midway. Mm-hmm. There's vendors, it's a tourist thing. Mm-hmm. During, I think, around from 1980 to 1982, it's only 2 weeks in the summer, my sister would end up working and living there. Mm-hmm. And she's a few years my senior, and my father, a self-employed man, and overprotective as hell, would show up every day. Right. Mm. So Every for 2 weeks in the summer, I was let go on a midway for ever. You know, like, here's $20, and like they had Freaks back then, and you know, Dark sure. Rides, and you know, the woman turning into the gorilla. Like, I was in heaven, but there was a comic yeah. booth. Every year there was a card booth and a comic booth, and this is the why I'm okay. the geek I am today. The comic booth was selling back issues, which blew my mind, you know, and they were all number ones. Devil Dinosaur, 2001, Machine Man.
Oh, cool.
And I bought all those thinking, oh, wow, they're number ones. These guys are idiots. These are going to be worth a fortune. Mm-hmm. And the other side, the card guy, I was buying Space 1999 cards and UFO stickers, and I didn't know what UFO was, and that never came up in my life again.
Wait, how old were you when you found UFO stickers?
10.
Wow.
And I was just kept okay. buying them, going, what is this show? This is so neat. On the last day of the X, my dad kept going. He was trying to sell stuff to Carnies and what have you. And we went to the comic booth on the end, and the guy said, you know, I have a store, right? And my dad took me to my first comic book store, which was the Silver Snail on Queen Street. This was about 1981. And
wow.
I bought more Kirby issues. But Kirby, I was buying all the 70s Kirby stuff because I was getting number ones, you know? And I bought the number one of Raiders there, too. Like,
it's like a four-issue series, and then they put a compilation together.
Yeah.
I think the Raiders was like a four issues.
But I walked into the vendor's building at the X this year with my kids, and there's a lavender cart. And there's always a lavender cart there. And I'm immediately, I just associate that with those comics. It's really a weird association, yeah.
No, it's like a lot of stuff we talk about. Like, you have that, you know, the first time you bought that magazine at that store whatever, and just every time you drive past it, it's like this
sense memory. Yeah, yeah.
The smell, all of it. Yeah, no, totally.
I just remember driving home reading those comics every night, you know? And it's just crazy.
Well, I think I got, you know, they used to do those paperback editions of like they put comics together in like a paperback book.
I got stacks of those.
And I had some of those.
Yeah.
And I remember that, you know, that famous shot in a Fantastic Four issue where Dr. Doom, the door opens up and the Fantastic Four are trapped and they're coming into this dinner and Dr. Doom is at the end of the table and reaching out, like, you know, which they riffed on in Empire Strikes Back with Vader.
Totally.
Like they kind of did. You know, that was in there, and I remember seeing that. And the other thing was, now that I'm kind of like, you know, 11 or 12, or kind of understanding, you know, who Kirby is or what his work, you know, looks like. Because I had like a Batman compilation, this hardcover that I still have, that had stuff up to like the early 70s, a lot of the Neil Adams stuff. And that's what I associate most with Batman.
Is that Batman stuff, to the 1930s to the 1970s with... Like it's a dust jacket on it. Is that the book you're thinking of? Because I have that as well.
I don't have the dust jacket, but I've got the book. Yeah. And it's like, so, and it's blue, right? It's like a blue cover with the Batman look.
Cover galleries on it. Yeah, yeah. It's got a lot of Two-Face stories for some reason. Yeah.
That was like my Batman internet when I was a kid. That's what kind of weaned me
onto Batman. I have the Superman one too as a kid.
And so I had some of those like paperback things where I kind of started to understand, you know, who Kirby was. Like, so Neil Adams I associate with Batman, you know, or vice versa. And then Kirby is Marvel to me. But then like certain characters, you know, like I think of Steranko's stuff, like his Captain America stuff and his Nick Fury stuff as like one of my favorite things of all time. Like, as much as I love Kirby, like that, what he did in that short amount of time, I mean, but Kirby is who I mostly associate with. Then I remember, you know, watching the opening credits of Thundar the Barbarian.
Oh yeah.
And there's a villain in the opening. I forget the name of the character that I think was probably going to be made into Wave 2 if they ever made those figures, where his head spins around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
yeah.
another face. And I remember seeing that every Saturday morning and going, why did that look familiar to me?
Yeah,
why did that?
I didn't make that connection why did until that adulthood.
And it was until I knew many years later that Kirby worked on the show. And of course that dude looks like a Kirby dude. And it sort of Ookla does. And all of it starts to kind of make sense.
Yeah.
But it's funny how that child, you know, brain sort of goes, well, that looks familiar. It doesn't make any sense. I don't know why I know that. you know, I wouldn't know that he'd be working on the show. And he also worked on I didn't know it when I was eight, but when you watch the 1978 Fantastic Four,
yeah,
he worked on that too.
I wonder how he felt like about that, because the show isn't very good. And
you mean how he felt about having to work on it?
I'm not a comic historian, but I think it's common knowledge that after a while he became kind of disenfranchised with the comic industry, and you know, he had moved to LA or at least California, and he got into animation somehow, and
yeah,
felt more validated by animation at the time, pitching all his ideas and such. And I just wonder how he felt about working on a bastardized version of his creations, that he really, the only way he was getting paid for them was to actually work on the show, which is really,
well,
you know,
there's a very sad story which people might know, but it's sort of kind of heartbreaking the first time I heard it. You know that, what's his name, Mark Evanier?
Yeah.
E-V-A-N. He was like tight with Kirby, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, he's very even keeled.
Very even keeled, and clearly, you know, I mean, backwards and forwards. And like, he did that Kirby book that came out a few years ago. Alex did a piece for that book, and he, you know, he knows the Kirby family and the history of Kirby, you know, backwards and forwards. But I don't know if I saw an interview or I read it in a magazine or something where he was out with Jack and his wife. I think he was driving them, and Jack was in the back seat, she was in the front seat, but they had to stop somewhere, and she gets out of the car to do something, and they're sitting in the parking lot, and there's a Toys R Us right there. And Mark turns back to Jack and says, "Hey, she's going to be in there for a while. Should we go in the toy store and look around?" And Jack said no. And he's like, "Oh, okay, you know." And then he kind of asked again, "Are you sure you don't want to just?" And he was like, "No." And he kind of was distant. And then it took a little while, but then Kirby said to him, "I can't go in there, because I'm going to go in there and I'm going to see all this stuff, all these characters that I helped design or, you know, had a part in or, you know, helped create and so on, or like a Captain America toy shield or whatever, and see all that stuff and know that I don't get anything from any of this."
Yeah.
And that had to be like, I don't know, late 70s, early 80s or something when that happened, or when he told the story.
Oh, yeah.
So I think there was a lot of that with Kirby too. I think he lived long enough to understand, to see the appreciation.
Yeah.
Like he was a legend already, but then the geek sort of grew up and they started, you know, doing Comic Cons and things like that where he started to get that kind of adulation, and he loved going to those things. But I think it's kind of like, I did that horror festival a few years back and did the thing about, Jack Pierce, the makeup artist for all the Universal stuff. And I talked to Rick Baker, because I ran into him at this thing and we started talking. I said, "Yeah, I did the Jack Pierce thing the other day." And, you know, I was just kind of geeking out with Rick Baker, but in a cool way, like not like, "Oh," it was like, "Hey, what are you, of all the stuff that you've done, what are you most proud of, or what can you look back on and the most proud of," or something. And he said American Werewolf, because he said, "I think about the budget that we had, how quickly we did it, how we did it in daylight, you know, yada, yada, yada." And then I started talking about Jack Pierce, and I said, did he understand toward the end of his life just what, and he said, "Yeah, but he was very angry and very bitter about it."
Yeah.
Because once again, all this merchandise, all the Frankenstein stuff that's out there, that's Jack Pierce.
Yeah.
That's all Jack Pierce.
Oh, yeah,
I never think of that. Yeah. He did the Widow's Peak on Lugosi. He did The Man Who Laughs, Conrad Veidt, the thing that inspired the Joker. That was Jack Pierce, the Wolfman, Frankenstein's monster, Invisible Man.
I never really thought that he would be, but he lived through the 60s monster craze, and I think he was doing
And he was not, he was kind of, Baker said he was kind of a bitter old man, became kind of a bitter old man.
Yeah.
I guess. Which I suppose makes sense. But I think Kirby had a bit of that, but I think he saw the appreciation, you know, toward the end of his life.
I never heard anything bad about, like, fans never say, you know, he was really kind to fans, even when he wasn't, you know, like, there was some article. I think I have maybe two issues of the Jack Kirby collector. And there was one guy who wrote an article about how he published his first comic and gave Kirby a copy. And Kirby had said something to him like, "Okay, you did it. You made it. Now get out of this business. It'll eat you alive." And just told him this horrible thing. And he writes in this article, I thought Jack was just a bitter old kook, but or something to the point of that. He said, "Then I, you know, now years later, I realized I was terrible."
You think Kirby was trying to tell him, like, yeah, don't bother?
He thinks that Kirby was just trying to, like, kid, you know, he was doing a nice way of telling him not to get into the industry, but really, he wasn't good enough. It was a funny piece. One of my favorite pieces of Kirby is that he did some toy packaging briefly for Mattel in the early 70s.
The Big Jim?
He did Big Jim's Wolfpack. He seemed to do, I don't know if he did the design work on those characters, but he did the packaging art. And he did some That's of the vehicles, brilliant. And then he was replaced by John Buscema, I don't know how to pronounce that.
Buscema?
For the second run. Buscema? And I think that's because they worked with Marvel on getting the comic done for the packaging. But
right.
And he also did a Tarzan package, Tarzan stuff for Mattel in the mid-1970s.
Oh, really? Yeah. Was it which one? The one that's kind of the Big Jim body? The Tarzan with the big,
no, I,
big
I
Jim
mean, like,
body?
No, I mean, just Tarzan toys in general. The weird Tarzan toys that Mattel made. I'll try and find it and put it on this episode, because they're definitely worth it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it.
Wow, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
That Kirby did that.
I wish that the original art for the Big Jim Wolf Pack existed. And one of the things I want to mention, and I wish I had a really good copy of this, but I've got somewhere pictures of the Mexican version of one of the Big Jim vehicles. And of course, the Mexican Big Jim characters are different. You know, they got an invisible guy and a bionic guy.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody has painstakingly taken the Kirby artwork and drawn over it. And it's badass. And I've got to figure out where that is. I gotta contact my buddy Jesus about that, because I know he owns one of those vehicles. So
isn't there also like the Mexican stuff? It was Big Jim, but it said James Bond 007.
Dr. Steele's become a villain that looks almost exactly like a villain out of a Matt Helm movie. I think there's a villain in Murderer's Row that has like a steel plate on top of his head, and at the end Matt Helm uses a magnet, you know, like we all knew he would,
as you do,
yeah, to capture him. But that's a bizarre line. I don't know if they had real licensing for that.
I've never gotten a straight answer on what the hell that is, or whether it was actually licensed.
Because the rest
was an actual licensed thing.
The official Mattel stuff is a
004. Like a vehicle.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But the Mexican stuff has 007. You said something about, you were talking about the animation stuff that he did. And he then worked on Thundar, right? Like, he did a lot of design for that and the original characters and stuff, right? Didn't he? Thundar the Barbarian?
He absolutely did. And I believe Thundar was created by Steve Gerber.
Steve Gerber, that's right. Who did Howard the Duck. And he wrote, didn't he write the Conan comic too or something before he did Howard the Duck or something? Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think Steve Gerber created Howard the Duck. In fact, I think he fought Marvel for ownership of it. And if I'm not mistaken, his legal battle was funded by a comic called Destroyer Duck that had Jack Kirby artwork. Now I gotta know if I'm right.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, remember Comic Scene when you were a kid? The Starlog comic scene?
Sure.
I remember reading something about that. That was, at the height of their legal battle against Marvel, Kirby and Gerber teamed up and created Destroyer Duck. I am correct. I remember
now,
that.
Now, here's a question that maybe you can answer.
Okay.
Is, you know, I know I bring up Alex now and then, but it's like the guy's like Wikipedia, and he doesn't go on the internet, so I can ask him anything about the history of comics, and he's going to have an answer. Like, it's just ridiculous the way the guy, the way his brain works. And I've been trying to get an answer about, like, you know, I'm fascinated by that period in the mid to late 60s kind of thing, where the tide sort of turned and Marvel became this go-to place for hip people and, you know, college campuses, and it was the cool comic to be reading and stand soapbox and all that. And like, when specifically it sort of became this entity that you know, the counterculture sort of latched onto. And I'm trying to narrow down, like, when it started to happen.
College kids were into Marvel right when they were fresh off the shelves.
And it was, I think it must have been an offshoot of, like, The Hobbit was really big, and, like, the Lord of the Rings books, and you see in these comics where, like, Peter Parker's wearing a t-shirt that says Frodo Lives or something. You know, it was all part of that same kind of soup, and people were getting more into sci-fi and stuff like that.
There's good signs of it. There's some paperbacks that came out around that time that are, I think, to capture on the zeitgeist of that. So there's some, like, late 60s Marvel books.
Well, it's those. Do you have those two books, right? The collector's books, the Golden Age, Silver Age collectibles, Marvel stuff. Did we talk about those? Do you have those books?
I have one of them. I think I have the 70s one. Yeah.
Okay, so the one before that, the first edition, I'm looking through this thing, and I had no awareness that there was, like, a Doctor Strange T-shirt made in 1965 or something.
Yeah, there's some really...
Or that there was that it's like, wow, I really didn't think this stuff took off until 67, 68 or whatever. Like, these characters that are on products way back then, it kind of puts it in a new
very house brand too. They did, like, inflatable pillows, and that stuff is so collectible too. That early Smith,
and it goes
60s.
Back a lot earlier than I thought.
Yeah.
That people were, I guess I didn't even understand that Spider-Man. You know, once you hear the story about the Ben Cooper costume, like, when that first one came out, you realize, wow, that's not long after character first hit.
Yeah.
This stuff, you know, was big, and there was this huge following. But the question is, like, when exactly did Kirby become this brand?
Yeah.
Like, you know, when did it become like, hey, guess who's working on this one? Guess who's coming? Because I know he left in the early 70s, went over to DC, and then came back to Marvel in 75 or 76 or something.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it...
Do you know when that sort of happened?
Yeah, I do. It
became a household name?
Well, I think as soon as stuff like the fan... Like, when he teamed up with Lee, one of, like, love him or hate him, Lee promoted those people as celebrities. And that's when things changed, when he stopped becoming just the anonymous artist of this book and, you know, became Jack Kirby. I mean, you know, putting people's names on comics, it seems so common and everyday now, but that was unheard of back then. You know, pick up any Gold Key comic from the 60s and who drew it, who wrote it, nobody knows.
Well, and that's why, as much as, you know, there's a lot of people out there that loathe Stan Lee, and I'm sure there are things that he's done that make him not so nice, but that's what I always say in his defense, was, like, he put, you know, faces to these artists, or names to these books, and guess who's going to be on this one, and unfortunately they didn't get financial recognition that they, you know, should have or hoped to or whatever, but I don't know if anybody did, you know.
It's
that's a whole weird thing.
It's a whole thing.
Somebody had to be the guy out front you know, George Lucas and Walt Disney didn't do it all. There were, you know, hundreds of people they stood on the shoulders of that did stuff and that made things and that designed things. But they're kind of the one out front that sort of tends to get the credit because they're the brand. They're sort of who gets branded with it. But Lee did a lot to get those people recognition in those books.
Yeah, I think he did, and I think, you know, again, I don't want to get into the Stan versus Jack debate because some people get really, really angry and vicious about it. I've seen some online fights that are like, God, what is this? You know, like it's a debate. We all weren't in the bullpen. We all don't know. I mean, we have our ideas and opinions, but I've seen some people just get like frothing about it, and it's like this is very weird for me. I think one of the things I think of regardless of what you think who did what, I think the partnership really clicked and really worked. And, you know, I think the same of Lee and Ditko, Lee and Kirby. I thought they really connected and had something. And the thing I always think of is none of them, after they all split, it was never quite the same. Lee's work wasn't as good. I think I love some of the stuff he did for DC after he left Marvel, especially Commandy and Mr. Miracle and that. But there's a quality to them, and there's something. Again, it's just all these ideas, but the dialogue and the structure.
I know what you're gonna say. And I'm gonna say this, and it's probably gonna get me in trouble with people, but whatever. That not everybody. I mean, Stan did what he did very, very well. Yeah. Some of the arguments that people use about the books was that, Kirby plotted it. Kirby's really the one who plotted it, wrote in a bunch of dialogue as he's doing these panels, and then Stan would come in and polish it and make it what it was. Well, I've read stuff like that Captain America Mad Bomb book from 76, the writing is his stuff on its own, as a writer and an artist, is just not up to snuff with the other Marvel stuff and the other writers that worked on those books. And I think that's one of the things he that pissed him off, that he wanted more recognition and wanted to be the one to write stuff, whatever. And I think Stan, like, again, like you say, love him or hate him, he seemed to be able to step back and know who had what talent and who was being used the right way.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that he's the one that was the kind of master of the dialogue and you know, a lot of this stuff. And some of the Jack stuff is just, it's gorgeous to look at, but did you ever see that one that he did? I don't know when this was, but he did a book that didn't get published, but you probably saw it like in the Kirby Collector or something, where he tells his childhood story of growing up like in the streets of Brooklyn or something, or wherever he's from, you know, running around with these kids, like the dead end kids, you know, and they're all kind of, you know, and then there's going to be a stickball game down by the playground. And then we go there and, you know, and he just tells me like this rough and tumble, like he's, you know, like he's Chaplin, you know, tramp sort of walking through.
Well, yeah, he did grow up in that time, you know.
He did, but everything he writes in this book is like, if somebody, you know, trips and falls, it's like, you know, there's you know, crash, bam, wallop, and there's, everything is just huge. Every sentence ends with an exclamation mark. Everything is huge and grandiose. Even just telling the tale that he did about, you know, growing up as a kid on these streets or whatever. And he just, if you read some of his stuff, I've got some old issues, the Captain America and Falcon issues, because I found them at a comic shop a couple months ago, and I just thought, oh, this would be fun to look through these. Every sentence ends with an exclamation mark. Everything that he writes, there's something huge, you know, happening in this sentence, or like every other word is boldface. You know, he just wasn't as good at the dialogue.
And the other thing was, and I hate to be, but like when I was coming into comics, when I started 12 years old, I found a lot of his work, like this isn't just him, a lot. I was just having this discussion with my son last night where he was saying, you know, my son was saying, I'm not liking Jim Lee's work anymore. And it's like, yeah, everybody kind of, I think everyone hits a wall sometimes, you know. creatively, and that can be true for writers, and it can be true for artists. But I was telling him my story of disappointment with Kirby, because I used to just buy anything he did at that point. And and it's gorgeous, but it's also weird. Is that I was in a variety store one day, and there was a comic called Battle for a 3D World. And it was a sealed baggie with 3D glasses, and I could tell whose art it was. And God, I had to have it, because it was 3D. And at that point, you know, I would go to any movie that was in 3D. You know, that was a really, really important thing for me at that time. So I saved up the $5 or whatever it was. It was expensive. I remember that. And I bought this 3D comic. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's more or less selling the concept, and they just let Kirby go nuts with it. And his stuff in 3D is really fun to look at. But it's not a memorable... I think that... What was the name of the character in it? First of all, it's not... It was actually not written by Kirby, which I wish it kind of was. But the art is, you know, the art is nice, but he's starting to kind of... what is the name of that? I want to just go through. I just remember being kind of disappointed with it. Sterion is the name of the character. Yeah. No, his art, when I look at it now, his artwork was great, but I think a lot better than I remember it, actually. But just after that, he did the, and I'm sorry the story's going over, he did the Superpowers. He did the Superpowers miniseries for DC Comics. And I was stoked to get that. And I do not think it's good. I'll be honest with you.
There seems to be a lot of affection for it. I don't know. I don't think I ever read it. But people seem to love the book, too,
right? Yeah, I just... I wasn't fond of the art, and I don't think his heart was in it when I look at it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll get... lynched for it, but I remember thinking, like, you know? And then, of course, he was doing a comic at the time. He was working for Independence at the time, and that was, you know, a shame. I thought he deserved more, but he was working for Pacific Comics, I think. He was doing something called Captain... do you remember this? Do you remember this Captain Universe, or... Yeah.
No.
Oh, God.
No.
Not Captain Universe. Kirby Captain. Sorry, I have to do this. Everyone, I'm just gonna get.
He did some stuff toward, you know, like in the. Wouldn't he die in 96 or something?
He died in 1994.
He was doing some. 94, because he was doing some new stuff like in the early 90s. They were putting out new stuff.
Yeah, yeah, like Bomb Blast.
I forget what they were.
Weird stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers. That was it. And I've never read these comics, but
I
have read
about that.
That they're a bit, that there's a bit of, they're kind of bizarre. So,
like, you know, I'm looking at this. I don't normally do this when we do the show to look at anything that's for reference, but I've got the Silver Age collectibles book here.
Oh, yeah.
And first of all, a ton of the merchandise that was being made. Like 66 Incredible Hulk and Thing sweatshirts. It's Kirby art.
Oh yeah,
but I can't believe that in 1966 there was a Thing sweatshirt.
Yeah,
that was made.
That's bugging you, eh? But they sold like half a million.
No, it's not. It's not
that
it's bugging. But that's the thing. They would talk about sales of the issues. You didn't know. Let's say you put the May issue out in, you know, April or something. Here comes the May issue. You didn't get the results of how that thing did for months. Like they didn't know for, I think, 2 or 3 months just how much this thing sold. So everything had to sort of, you know, assume they were going to make at least 4 or 5 issues and hope it did well because they had that stuff in the hopper, you know, to get going.
But they would get tons of letters. And
yes, they did. And know. I knew that the comic had the popularity they did back then. I guess I didn't realize that in 1965 there was a Daredevil T-shirt that was made. I didn't know that he was well known enough in 65 to get his own T-shirt.
I guess they just invested in the shirt.
You know, Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos. There's a Kirby T-shirt there. Daredevil, Doctor Strange, which is Ditko Arts. But yeah, I mean, just about everything in here, you know, a ton of the merchandise that was made, it's all Kirby. It's all Kirby's art on the packaging.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I was very happy to see the Kirby family get a settlement from Disney.
Yeah.
Over these movies. I mean, it's long overdue.
Yeah.
And you know, you look at a movie like Thor Ragnarok and you go, there's so much.
Oh, I love it.
There's just so much here, you know.
I love that they did that. I love that they that's where they chose to go with it, with the sets and the guards, and because I've always wanted to be able to get, you know, that, like, we're never quite going to get that. I don't think we're ever going to get a full on Kirby, because I don't know if you could, like, if you couldn't translate what he did or his art.
I think his stuff looks amazing though. Like,
it does, but it's not, the thing about it is that, so, and again, you know, talking to Alex, he's someone that, and you may be like this too, because the way you sort of see, the whole thing is like, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like, sort of thing. Like, I can look at something and go, aesthetically, that's not, whereas you and Alex might look at it and focus on the neck and why the neck isn't right and why the chin should be out a little bit more, the head should be different, you know, like with costumes and things like that, because he tends to think completely visually. And when he talks about this stuff, we had a great chat one time about Kirby, and you know, Kirby's art is insane. It doesn't, they don't look, there's no real attempt to look like a human face. You know, there's a structure there, but none of it makes any sense. And the closest thing I can think of, and I said this to him, and he literally dropped the phone. I'm like, Michael Shannon. Like, Michael Shannon has a Kirby face. Like, if you could, if you could put that face in a, you know, Mr. Miracle or something, or make a movie, like, that's the guy you get, because that's the way he draws faces. They just kind of don't make sense. Their eyes are far apart.
I'll give a weird confession. I find Kirby women really attractive. I always have.
They're big and meaty. Really, they're tough.
That upsets the hell out of my wife, who is not a fan. She doesn't get it. And she's like, I was like, yeah, I think his Medusa and Crystal are honeys. You know, I think they're just gorgeous.
There's something, you know why? Because there's something kind of Russ Meyer about them. That's why you like them.
Could be.
There's a little bit of that.
I have a theory about that too, is, I have a huge proportion issue. Like, if I'm looking at something and the hands are too big, or the head's too small, it really, I empathically, like, that, put it, like, there was a Toy Biz released a Riddler figure in the early 90s that had, he's holding a piece of paper, and if you look at it, his hands are just like just enormous, and he's got a pinhead. And I remember, like, picking up that card and going, dah, and, like, putting it down because it bothered me. I never think of that with Kirby because everything is so immersive. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the people look that way, the buildings look this way, you just accept it for what it is because everything is sort of uniform to his idea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I know he had some perspective issues occasionally, and there's some really funky, wild covers, but there's an OMAC cover that everyone, you know, where he's throwing a guy in a bathtub, and it's a weird, but I just love that whole universe that he creates there. I really do too.
It's, again, you know, when you mentioned someone like Jim Lee, for example, like, I look at Jim Lee and I see a lot of stuff out there since that is interchangeable to me. If I look at, I look at Kirby or Steranko or even Alex or whoever, you know who it is when you see that work, and you know Kirby's stuff. There's no mistake.
Yeah.
And that's part of the attraction to it, is that it's just mental. Like the proportions and the the design. It's gorgeous and it works perfectly for what it is, but it's stylized. It's not, there's not a huge attempt to make these, make them, you know, more recognizable as humans. There's a 1968 frame tray puzzle by Whitman in here. 1968, with the Fantastic Four fighting the Black Panther.
Yeah, that's right.
The first Black Panther item. There's a sparkle paint set too that has the Silver Surfer, which is from '67, which I guess was the first Silver Surfer thing. But this 60 stuff is fascinating, and how much of this stuff is all Kirby. Like we talked about this before. It's another thing that again I wouldn't have known at the time, but I understood that it was Kirby, but didn't exactly know that it was Kirby. For example, oh, and Kirby did. That's the thing about Black Panther, right? It was going to be it was Kirby and Lee, right? Black Panther.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So and that was it was gonna be the initial mask. Was going to be open from the nose down, like the chin, like Batman's mask, and that way you'd know it was a black guy. And Marvel said, "You can't do that. No way. We won't be able to sell that comic, you know, in parts of the country. You can't do it. That's why the mask."
So we'll fool the kids.
Exactly.
It's not
that's
like
why
he kept his mask.
I know. I know. But do you remember these? They're in here, and this is one of the things I was kind of looking for. And I don't know what the company was here. Philadelphia Chewing Gum Corporation. They made these Marvel superhero stickers that aren't the ones. I have the ones from the '70s, but they're like goofy, you know, like. Like there's a picture of Iron Man scratching his helmet, his head.
Yeah, there's wacky captions.
It says, "Let's see now, what's good for Russ?" You know, or like Spider-Man, it'll say, "You were expecting, you know, Little Miss Muffet or whatever." A lot of that artwork.
Yeah, there's
is
that cynicism in there. Yeah. They couldn't just sell straight superhero stuff. They had to make them wacky.
It was Kirby, and again, that's a very strong childhood memory that. Those stickers that my first grade teacher, if you did something good or you cleaned the chalkboard or whatever, you got to stick your hand in a coffee can that she had that had little treats in it and, you know, pull some out. And I was hooked on those superhero stickers. And so I would feel around for the card and then pull that out and get a new one each time. And then I stuck them on my wooden headboard in my bedroom when I was about 7.
Yeah.
Like an idiot. And I don't know how my
like
parents...
Like an idiot, like every kid.
I don't know how my parents... What ever. Took them so long, because I kept building this library on the headboard. And then one day, finally, my mother saw it and went, "What are you doing?" And they freaked out because they couldn't get the stickers off the headboard and I ruined it, basically.
Dude, I ruined my bedroom. I had built-in desk and cabinet into the walls. And, you know, I had the tops... Empire Strikes Back cards, and I was able to spell Brian with the letters. Remember that they had letters?
I never could figure that out, why they did that. And, it was the dumbest idea.
I loved it, and I remember friends coming over going, "Oh, you got an R!" You know, like the, I guess the kid's named Richard and stuff. You know, like, R was really valuable, you know. And,
I never understood that. I could never figure that out. Why they did letters?
Letters with photos of, like, Luke Skywalker? I don't know. Why not?
It was dumb. It was so dumb. I never understood
it. I was into it.
This
kid loved it.
So, yeah, a lot of the Kirby stuff I think of, too, is not just the books I was getting as a kid. It was all the damn merchandise. Well,
For sure. Not seeing a dime of the... Especially the late 60s and then probably the 70s. It was probably really... I can see his point, you know. And I, you know, regardless of where I feel about the Stan Lee relationship, he did get screwed. And he deserved better accolade. And even though, you know, his family got some money now, he deserved to be living when he got, you know, his art back and I think he never got his original art back, you know, and
Well, they've
I've
got
also
a,
heard stories that people kind of took advantage of him as he got older, and that just disgusts me. You know?
Well, it's funny you say that, because when I was at Comic-Con, I started to look at these limited edition prints that were done, and there was one that there was a stack of Captain America signed by Kirby, Lee, and Joe Simon, I think, had all signed these things. You know, yeah, but that's the thing, is you know, and I hope, I'm sure they're not listening, but you're suddenly talking to the guy who runs the booth, and it's kind of like, what are these? And where do these sort of come from? Oh, well, that was a thing that I worked on back in the, you know, back in the late 80s. It was what we did, 1986, and we did that. And then I got Stan to sign a bunch, and then what I did was took over to Joe. And by the time he finishes the story, I'm looking at this staff stuff going, I don't know if this is any of their signatures. I don't know if he just stuck a pen in their hands and told them to do it. I don't know. Because it was like, I think the one print was like $250 and one was like $350 or something. And I have no way to gauge what that stuff is worth. Yeah. But yeah, it seemed like there was a lot of that stuff that toward the end of his life, it was like stick a pen in his hand and, you know, give him a few bucks to sign.
And it's going on with Stan Lee right now a little bit.
That's a whole, you know, that's a whole weird thing about the daughter and the money and, you know, all that strangeness. But yeah, so that's, but yeah, like I said, I think he, you know, by the time you got to, because, you know, there were those, you know, comic book conventions and Marvel conventions in the mid 70s and stuff that I think he was probably treated
but
like
a
rock
star. Those weren't, you treated like a rock star, but you probably didn't make a lot of money doing them either. I mean,
no. And that's why I would imagine something like Thundar or the Fantastic Four, you know, the animated shows, like that was probably, you know, kind of a king's ransom for, you know, at the time, if you worked on a regular show like that. Don't you think? For
well,
like
it,
Kirby,
probably
like,
was, it was probably, yeah, I think he deserved better in life.
No, I do too. I'm saying that's probably why it was so attractive to him to do things like that, was because it was a regular gig that paid probably more than, you know, what he was getting in comics.
Probably. It's steady work, and maybe it was more rewarding. I know that, I mean, like, I think he worked on some pretty crummy shows, too, you know? Like, but
did he work on the Thing cartoon on its own? Did he work on that one?
Oh, I hope not. I hope he didn't get subjected to doing that. That one would be just so sad.
Thing Ring, Do Your Thing? Is that what he said in that?
Ring, oh, if he had to do that, I would... I know for a fact that... No, he didn't have... Turbo Teen, that was the cartoon I was thinking of that
Turbo
he probably
Teen.
Wasn't so happy. Turbo Teen was where that kid turned into a car. Oh, it was horrible. Just horrible.
I don't even remember that. Turbo Teen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think he worked on Goldie Gold and Action Jack, which is a show I actually unironically enjoy.
Wait, Goldie Gold?
Goldie Gold and Action Jack. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the one that was kind of a Raiders ripoff, right? It was like 81 or 82.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah. We had that. We had Goldie Gold. We had Tales of the Gold Monkey. And we had Bring Him Back Alive, Bruce Boxleitner.
Oof, never saw that. Yeah.
Oh, I used to watch it every week because I'm like, that's the guy from Tron. And they're trying to make an Indiana Jones type show. It was awful. It was terrible. But you better believe I watched.
I think my wife's a fan. But I just reminded going through all this. Do you remember the Eternals comics?
Not, I know of them, but not as a kid. No.
Yeah, I bought those as a kid and had no clue what was going on. I remember that really specifically, like being drawn to the Kirby art and going, "Oh yeah, I gotta have," and then going, I don't understand what's going on in this comic.
So when was that? When what?
That was like mid. He returned to Marvel, and they gave him all these projects that I think he wanted to do. Like, you know, obviously he got Captain America again. Mm-hmm. He got the Eternals. He did 2001. You must have heard about this, that they finally released his Prisoner.
Yes,
adapted the Prisoner.
That's how I was going to wrap up the show. That was my
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. That was my first purchase at Comic-Con this year.
Comic-Con?
Was that it's ginormous.
I haven't picked it up yet.
It's huge.
Is it?
Yeah, it's like right off the Masters. It's like this huge book. It's very thin, but it's the size of the you know, the panels that they would, and it's absolutely gorgeous. But I mean, half of it is Kirby, and the other half is Gil Kane. But yes, no, go ahead, say what you were gonna
Our, Canadian Comic Con is this weekend, and I might go pick that up.
Oh, you should get it. You should definitely get it. Because they did it where they, because Titan put it out, and what they did when we bought it at Comic-Con, they also are publishing a new Prisoner comic that has nothing to do with McGoohan, but it, and it's in that world, but it's not McGoohan's likeness. But what they did was they gave you a variant of issue one, which took the Kirby cover of the big omnibus that came out, and they and Mike Allred, who does Madman, he inked it. He colored in the cover. So when you got the book, you got this free issue of issue one with that variant cover that was it was colored in, the version of Kirby's art, but it was colored in. And that they might have that at the show when you go. But yeah, that was that was in honor of the 50th anniversary, and they because I think that was the only other time I think that was ever shown was one of those Kirby collector magazines, right? They had photocopies of some of it.
Yeah, they would tease little bits of it, and you'd just be sitting there going, "I need to read this."
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to see this.
It's so cool.
He also there was in one of the issues of Jack Kirby Collector that I own, they showed he pitched a Planet of the Apes cartoon series to Ruby Spears because he was a fan. He was a fan.
Oh wow. And, you know,
it was neat to see him draw the Planet of the Apes characters. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
You know.
Well, that's what's cool. That's the whole, that's the fun of the Prisoner thing is it's like, I don't really even, I mean, it's cool to see it. He's basically redoing the opening episode, you know, the opening credits a bit and then the opening episode, but it's just to see, again, you know, it's McGoohan, but it doesn't, it looks like Kirby's version of McGoohan. Yeah. It's kind of like, it's like, it's like, what's his name? Oh, crap. Not S. Raymond, but, oh my God, it's on the tip of my tongue. He did the Empire Strikes Back Marvel adaptation. He did the Flash Gordon one. He drew the Flash Gordon comic.
Oh my God.
And his name
Al Williamson.
On the tip of my, Al Williamson. Yeah. So you look at Al Williamson's movie adaptation of Flash Gordon or like Empire Strikes Back. You know that's Harrison Ford. First of all, he never did Sam Jones' image, and he kind of kept it looking like his Flash Gordon that he had drawn for a couple years before.
He was playing a little bit of, I found that he was kind of marrying the two, which I kind of liked. Yeah.
Yes, I did too. I did too, because he gets everybody else, you know, Von Sydow and Timothy Dalton. Like he kind of nails it. But you look at the Empire Strikes Back, it's like it's Harrison Ford, but it's like Williamson's version of Harrison Ford. He's still doing his stuff, and that's what Kirby stuff is to me. It's still, you know, he's putting his spin on it.
Yeah, of course, because it has to be brought into his world, and that's why it's beautiful. Yeah.
Right. So what I did this year, because I was getting more into Kirby, and I knew that Comic-Con was coming up, and the Prisoner thing I wanted to get and everything, I picked up the Jack Kirby's Fourth World Omnibus, Volume 1.
Okay.
That hardcover. And there's like, I don't know, four or five volumes. But this thing basically starts with, you know, the issue of like Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen or whatever, you know, goes and buys a Galactic or whatever. What is it?
One, please!
Superman. Can I get one, please? Superman's ex-pal, the new Jimmy Olsen. That's what the name of that book is. So the first time that they sort of get into this world, and just it's just gorgeous to read this stuff, but it's strange. Like what's funny is looking at some of these panels, you can see it as an animated.
Oh, yeah.
You can see it as a trippy late 60s animated film.
Yeah.
Like it's really, really trippy stuff.
Well,
everybody just looks, even the kids look like weird grown ups.
Very
strange. And he's got, you know? And he's got some weird panels that are like black and white photos and shit.
Yeah, they were doing that at the time. You know. Yeah, I remember that. And
so this goes into the first New Gods, and then it kind of takes you through those first issues. And, you know, the Superman's in here and Mr. Miracle and all that stuff. And, you know, it's pretty fun. I mean, I don't know if I've ever... Did you read this stuff when it came out, the Fourth World stuff?
No, I didn't. I read Commandees. I remember Commandy because There was an abundance of Commandees in 3-packs at discount stores, and it's post-apocalyptic. It was, you know, almost Planet of the Apes, and I think it was meant as almost Planet of the Apes, I was keen to read that, but I mostly picked up his Marvel stuff, like Machine Man and the Eternals and Devil Dinosaur. I read those quite a bit, actually. Not always following what was going on, but they were exciting to look at. And that was the one thing that, you know, he rarely let you down with, was how good it looked. And, of course, Captain America and Falcon, which I adore. And
I love that comic. My brother Jack read it, and he'd hand it down to me, and I just... That's why when they finally got into a movie...
Yeah.
Together, it was like,
so
oh my god,
yeah.
Finally seeing them in a movie, so awesome. What I love about that, too, the Winter Soldier, is that they got Redford in the movie, because if they had been able to make a Captain America movie in, like, the mid-70s, Redford would have been the guy. They would have cast Redford. The other thing I love about Kirby, and I think you'll appreciate this, is when he writes like hip dialogue that young people say, or
nobody's very good at that.
Put this group together called the Super Kids of the Century, the Forever People, and like one of them is like got a furry vest on, and the other one's wearing a scarf, and they're all kind of very now and happening, and you know, there's dialogue like, "I hear you right, thinkers. You're shouting anti-life, the positive belief. Listen as the great organ catches your words and finds the wonderful music in this." Like, just this trippy, like he's trying to latch on to the sort of the new age
utopia
kind of thing. And it reminds all of that stuff that anybody does, all of it reminds me of, you know, what's the Star Trek episode about Eden? Yeah. We're going to Eden.
Herbert.
The Way to Eden. You know, are you one? I'm one. Are you one?
Is it wrong that that's probably the one I watch the most?
In fact, it makes perfect sense. That's the one that you watch the most.
And
that would
are like
be
my two favorite Star Treks.
And if somebody tied me up, put a gun to my head, and said, "Tell me Brian's first, their two favorite Star Treks," I would instinctively say probably Spock's Brain and the one about the hippies. I promise you those are Brian's favorite episodes. So whenever I see, like, you know, an episode of Dragnet or the way Kirby writes in the stuff or whatever, I think about that episode and how we say, like, how that stuff was, like, dated before it even aired. Like, as they're editing it, somebody went, this is already old hat, man. They've moved on from this.
I was watching a Dragnet, and Joe Friday's trying to get black guys to join the Force, and... I think he says something like, "The Force needs more good Negroes like you, Jim." And it's like, am I asleep right now? Did he just say that? It's so square.
Yeah, it's
just hip. And
I love that stuff when it's just you know, they're trying to do a special episode that sort of connects with the,
and it's insanely
the youth market or whatever.
Terrible.
And they have no idea how people talk. They have no clue. Well, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. And, you know, the other one does it too. What's his name? Denny O'Neill at DC. Denny O'Neill? Is that the guy I'm thinking of? He does a lot of that stuff too, where it's like, you know, "Oh, let me tell you something, Mr. Big Shot with the bow and arrow.
Yeah.
You think you know what's down, what's happening." You know, there's a lot of that.
To be honest, to be fair to Kirby, he wasn't the only person who couldn't write.
There's the
guy who was writing, and I can't remember his name, but I'm sure everyone yelling it. The Teen Titans comics of the late 60s, apparently. The name is on the tip of my tongue, but this guy had never met a teenager, ever. Like, you know, John Hughes famously went to malls and just sat there with a note like a creep and listened to kids talk. And that's why his movies resonated with us. That didn't happen with this guy who wrote Teen Titans, you know. The worst example of that hep talk is the 60s. Archie got back into writing superheroes, and they hired Jerry Siegel, and he was, you know, brought in, and he called himself Jerry S, like along sides of Stan Lee, and they said, you know, I think they told him make the comics like the way Marvel's doing them, and I can't tell if Siegel had completely lost his marbles, or if he was just taking a piss, because those comics are bizarre. They're like, I honestly think I would believe them to be parodies of Marvel, as opposed to actually a sincere attempt. Because if they're parodies of Marvel, they're brilliant. But if they're sincere attempts, it's like, wow, you know, like he was losing his mind, you know.
I've got a Captain America and Falcon comic right here, which is one of the batch that I bought, you know, a couple months ago. And this is Kirby. This is the Falcon. It seems too far out to consider. Yet when seen from the air, one can only conclude that this thing is a king size. And then he says, I think I've stumbled into Nick Fury's favorite nightmare file, 116. Falcon, you've been hung on the horns of a dilemma.
Yeah.
You know, shit like that, like this white guy writing jive, you know.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
You won't shake me, mister. I'm going to stick to your tail until I can get a good look at you. The game's over, cutie pie. I'm making my play. Jumping catfish. Yeah. I can't change course. That kind of shit. It's all over the Marvel stuff of the early 70s. And Kirby's really, he's not the only one.
Oh,
by
God,
any means. No. But I just adore it. I adore that stuff. I could read that stuff for days.
Well, it's
you know, Cap is as earnest as ever, but Falcon is there just kind of laying it on him.
Well, I think you know? I think
it's like in the book and record. What's the book and records? Power
Record?
I have
that one, the Captain Falcon one.
Which is brutal, by the way. That one and the one with Man-Wolf with Spider-Man, the endings are the most downbeat.
Yeah, well, I don't know
Sad
if you know this,
of any child's
Power,
record
no,
ever.
Power Records Man Thing opens with a clown killing himself.
Yes. I mean, with no one, like, did they just say kids can take it back then? Like, they're fine. They're going to be fine. We're in the middle of they're seeing shit on Watergate in Vietnam right now. They'll be fine. They can handle
those,
a clown
those
taking
kids
it online.
Are bulletproof now. The
they're
president
fine.
Just quit.
They can handle that. They love it. Yeah, it's there's something in that. I can't remember the line now, but there's something in that Cap and Falcon Power Records where, you know, Captain America, of course, and I love the voice.
Oh, they're amazing.
I love
the
voice work on those things. And some of the ones, like the Star Trek ones, some of those are really wonderful. Like the guy doing Kirk and McCoy, like they're pretty damn good.
Yeah,
it's not like they cast.
Really hard.
They couldn't have cast this huge net all over New York or wherever to say, we're doing auditions for the next 2 weeks. Let's see if we can nail down a Kirk for this record. We're going to get paid $25 for this, and that's it. They, considering all that, they got some great voices on those records. And when you listen to that Cap and Falcon, it's like, Captain America is sort of like this, and I don't know. It's been too long, Sam, but tell me again, and maybe it'll be fine.
Falcon
is just like, as hip as can be, like everything he says to Cap is like, "What's your problem, man? Don't be jiving me." the whole story.
Falcon will be voiced by Myron Flassburg. The Cap and Falcon one has been sampled in several rap albums.
The Power Records
maybe,
one.
Maybe I should use the word hip hop so I don't sound like Yeah, it's been sampled quite a bit, actually. I was just watching something the other night, a YouTube television.
Is that that new rap?
That
new
fangled rap music
about?
The kids are into. You know, I always.
Is that part of the new wave?
I always wondered what, like, my kid. Because I loved rap, and I love punk, obviously, and I was into death metal and all, you know, speed metal and thrash and all that. So I was always wondering, like, what is my kid going to get into? Because I'm kind of like this musical omnivore, you know, like, and I was wondering what my kid was going to rebel musically. You know what my kid's into is, like, the Ink Spots. Yeah, oh, wow. He went fantastic. Like there, and it's sort of like, oh, okay. You know, but like,
you know, I would have thought, since you turn them on to so much stuff, and what I love about what you do with them is you kind of, it's like you give them a tray of sort of, you know, appetizers and go, here's a bunch of stuff. I think it's cool. You don't have to like it. If you like it, great. And they latch on
to what they like
by being sort of turned on to it. When you, and they find out what they... Yeah, and I've never really asked you, but I'm assuming you do that with music sometimes, too, where you're like, this is the stuff I'm into, and, like, see who, you know... And they and so nothing like the Ramones or Sig Sig Sputnik or any of the other stuff you're into? They haven't, like, sort of jumped on?
Sig Sig... No, like I don't
know you
like
so well.
I listen to I like it goes all over the place. I will put the Sex Pistols on, then Neil Diamond, then the Butthole Surfers, then Lawrence Welk. I own Lawrence Welk records. It just whatever mood I'm in, you know, and it goes all over the place. The only thing I can say is my daughter hates Mazzie Star. She hates when I play it. She just calls it sad, kill yourself music. And that's the only one. That's the only one that really gets on her nerves, is that one.
Mm.
Which I love Mazzie Star. So,
Well, you'll appreciate this. I was at a recording session yesterday. My friend Malcolm is in town. Last year they were here, about a year and a half ago. Didn't I tell you that I did hand claps on a track? Tony Visconti produced these two records. Daphne Guinness, she's doing an in-store at Amoeba that I helped set up for next week. And so when they were here like a year and a half ago, I was in the session and I did hand claps for the tune. And so I've got a credit in the liner notes, hand claps LA, Jason Lindsay, hand claps London, Matt Berry. We're on the same track. So he and I are on the same track, and we're in the liner notes, which I couldn't be more excited about. But yesterday they had a session at a studio here, and Clem Burke of Blondie was on drums, and Roger Joseph Manning of Jellyfish was on keyboard.
You're a big fan of Jellyfish.
So that, huge Jellyfish fan. That was a big highlight for me, of the month, basically. And then the gig on the 5th was just, you know, meeting Clem Burke and sort of hanging out for a bit was pretty damn cool. That's like, really cool. Holy crap.
Wow.
But the prisoner thing is, you definitely have to pick that up.
That
was like the big
curvy. That is definitely what I'm going to pick up if I see it at Fan Expo this weekend, and that's on my sites. I also would very much like to get the 2001 Treasury Edition now. I don't know if I'll get that at Fan Expo because... it's not exactly a friend prices venue, you know. The rent's really high there, and I know every year I go and look at the $500, you know, loose Shogun Warriors and go, meh, I don't think I'll buy anything, you know. But I you know, I picked up one of these from Entertainment Earth, which is the Super 7 Lords of Light Kirby figure.
Oh, yeah. I picked that up, too.
The card was, like, I don't just... buy a lot of new toys, and I had to have that. I mean, it's just so epic and cool, and I really wish there was more stuff like this that embraced the creator. Like, you know, this is exactly like I would love to buy a Thing and a Mr. Fantastic and anyone he made that was done like he drew them. You know, like, let's do that. Mm-hmm. That's childhood to me, and I want that, and I would give you the money out of my wallet for it. So I...
There is, I will say this, there were a few, I don't know if it was under New Gods or Fourth World figures that DC Direct did about 10, 12 years ago, maybe?
Yeah, they even did a Command, and they did which I don't believe I bought, and I should have.
And they did a Superman that is completely a Kirby sculpt. I think they did a Mr. Miracle. There's a Superman that came out of that line.
Offended or famously bothered by his Superman. Have you ever heard that story that
Redraw
his head?
But, Well, that's the thing. Is I was going to mention that, because you look in this book, Superman is in this book, and you're like, the one face that stands out in this that looks nothing like Kirby is the Superman. And it's, I'm like, did they, how much did they mess with it? It looks like Kirby doing the body.
Yeah, they would just bring in Kurt's, the way the hands are. They brought in Kurt Swan to do the head.
Kurt Swan? Yeah, that makes total sense. Well, they, in this line that they did, I don't know what book he actually appeared like this, but it's, I've got it in my case. It's definitely a Kirby sculpt, and they did two or three other characters, like Mr. Miracle, and I think they did a Dark Side maybe as well. Also, in issue number 139 of Superman, Kirby's Fourth World of Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen. Are you ready for defoliants in your succotash? Are you ready for landmines in your lunchbox? Are you ready for this? Two Rickles. Don and his long-lost alter ego, Goody.
I was hoping you would bring this up.
It could only happen.
Yeah.
Yes. It could only happen.
Yeah, and also, like, you know, they finally put their finger on the pulse of what the young people were into, and it was Don Rickles.
The kid. They went right to Don. Yeah. Right to Don. They said, no, Harold Lloyd's out this month. Let's go to
CPO Sharky.
Let's go to Don Rickles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty fantastic. Two Rickles.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that ludicrous cover of them holding his picture. And it's
with the picture, the portrait.
It's
just
like,
see, if you look at it, there's something about it's to me that besides the bulk of the characters, the bodies, the poses, etc. It's the way it's where he places the eyes on their head. They are on opposite sides of their head, like they're almost at their ears. They're so far apart, and it's incredible art. But it's Kirby and only
and
Kirby.
I mean, I'm such a fan of his expressions and his dynamic flow, the way things go, the way things are exaggerated. I'm not saying anything that people haven't heard before or read, but it's just my personal. That to me has always been comics, and no one's ever really, like, you know, I know Bruce Timm is a big fan and has done his own take on it, but I don't think we're ever going to get another Jack Kirby. I don't think that's ever going to happen.
I don't think
we're ever going to get another Steve Ditko. Either, you know, like, just they were their own thing, and I think that was a once in a lifetime, and I'm happy that he was part of my childhood very much, actually, and I think that
anybody that would even, you know, the second you try to even attempt to emulate in any way, you're just gonna look like a copy of Kirby. Like, it's so distinctive, there's no way to sort of, you know, distill it. If you think about, you know, music, you've got hybrids that go on. You know, to me, everything sort of branches off from the hybrid that the Beatles sort of created, from everything that they were influenced by that became, you know, a pop music thing, or that changed, or the mod thing that became punk and whatever. But, like, Kirby stuff is, like, there's no... It just is what it is. There's no... I don't know anybody that sort of comes close to the way he drew. He also did things with faces that were kind of disturbing. You know, those cover shots where, like, let's say a mob is, like, tying someone up and, you know, carrying them through the streets, or there's some kind of riot going on or something. The way he drew people, you know, or being angry with that sort of lopsided face and one eye open and the other eye kind of squinting and massive. Like, he drew
That's one of the reasons I don't like his superpowers, is I hate the way he draws the Joker. The Joker doesn't even look kind of human, you know? It's too exaggerated, and I don't know. That's just my opinion. Like, if
do you have the Kirby book?
No, I don't. The books I own are... I own the first 10 issues of Fantastic Four in a hardcover. I own the first 10 issues of Commandy in a hardcover. Then I own you know, various Kirby stories in different publications. But I don't own a Jack Kirby book at all, actually, which is surprising.
Yeah, and you know, for a second there, I thought I did. And now I suddenly can't find it.
Oh.
I swear I have the Kirby book. I thought I did. Well, I did. I think I do. It's somewhere. But there's some great stuff in there, and Alex did sort of a tribute where he kind of aped a piece that Kirby did. He did it in his style, sort of.
Yeah, I love
yeah, king, that's why he's the king.
Yeah, that's definitely why he's the king. And I think I'm gonna buy myself a Kirby comic this weekend. And it was his 101st birthday yesterday. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. No, this is a good. It's a good call.
Yeah, I thought this was a lot of fun.
Well chosen.
And so, to you out there in listener land, tell us your favorite Kirby art. Tell us your favorite Kirby work.
Yeah.
But I wanted to mention just before we go, he not only did he touch the Prisoner, which I love, but he also did the Black Hole comic strip for Disney.
Oh, I don't think I ever knew
really
that.
It's really cool looking, too. Like, I like his take.
You mean like a newspaper strip? Has that ever been released?
I don't think it's ever been collected, but it's out there. It's, you know, I love his art in that. And, of course, you know, he's the perfect artist to do that story. You know, he lends his own, you know, like, I'm more curious to read 2001 because it's not a very action-packed thing. I know he was a fan of it. He was a science fiction fan. He really wanted to do it. But I'm more curious to see how he makes that interesting. Because I know he does. You know?
Well, he clearly was... I don't know enough about him to really comment on this, but if you didn't know better, like, as sort of happens with a lot of products, that you assume people making it, you know, might be a certain way or imbibe.
Yeah.
You know, like when you look at Ditko stuff and Kirby and even Steranko, but although Steranko might have dabbled in things, I don't know. But they don't strike me as men that were like dropping a tab before they sat down and tried to make. But there is you can understand why so much of that stuff appeals
to the drug culture. Yeah.
Kids on college campuses and the drug culture, because it was a trip, you know, and he really saw things with a different eye, the way he sort of created these environments.
Yeah, a friend of mine, you know, who since passed away, told me that in the 60s, when you went to see 2001, the floor was just full of people tripping on acid. You know, they would pop acid before that ending, to watch that ending, you know, high as a kite. And that's an interesting thing. So people were looking for that sort of, you know, like a lot of people assume that Steve Ditko was for Doctor Strange. He was clearly, you know, just popping acid. And of course, I couldn't have been further from the truth. The guy was a pretty strange dude. And I think the same with Kirby. These were just, you know, the thoughts pouring out of his head. I don't think he was, I've never heard any stories of him being, you know, into counterculture like that.
You know, what's funny about that 2001 thing at the end of the movie, 11 years later, those same people apparently grabbed acid that they had left over and tried having the same experience at Star Trek The Motion Picture.
They all just went to bed?
Getting through that. They all just went to sleep, trying to get through that cloud for 45 minutes. trying to reach Regis. They fell asleep in the theater. The drugs didn't work anymore. It's 79. It didn't work.
Because
that's what they were trying to do. I mean, that's kind of what Roddenberry or whoever it was thought. We can do this thing and bring it back, and it's going to be, so let's do like a 2001 sort of thing too. That's we're not popcorn like Star Wars. Let's be the serious science fiction thing we can be, and we're going to give them a 2001 experience.
Yeah. How'd that work out?
No, didn't happen. Yeah. Just didn't quite happen. But you know, we got to see Decker in his tight. as worth the price of admission.
On that note. Yeah, I don't know who pointed that out to me, but I hate you because I can't watch that movie anymore, especially with today's more high-definition televisions. That movie's ruined. All right.
That was Bowie giving his two cents.
He's a big...
He's very upset we were talking about Deckard.
He's a big fan of Stephen Collins, is he?
Big fan of Stephen Collins. Don't talk about him
now. He hasn't Googled in a while, has he?
Okay, all right, well, that was great. On that note, Bowie's freaking out, so...
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Make yours Marvel or DC, and we will be back resoundingly quick with a new show.
Thank you, guys.